Moments, we'll stand and sing the song that Danny has selected as a song to encourage those who may need to render their obedience to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Before I begin, I knew there were two or three other things this morning that I had intended to say, and only one of them maybe is still applicable at this point. I heard at the very end of the week from Sister Elizabeth Cleghorn, who has worshiped periodically with us on Wednesday evenings. Her daughter, as most of us were aware, in the state of Florida, had cancer and died recently. And on this past Saturday, long after we were able to get the information and get it to all of us, they did have a memorial service in Richmond, Indiana, where the Cleghorns live, in her memory. While there was not anything that was going to be able to be done by us in view of that particular situation, seeing how, as we learned about it just almost barely before it took place, I did intend to bring over tonight the address of the Cleghorns in Indiana in case there would be anybody here who might want to communicate with them in regard to the loss of their daughter. If you would like that information, if you'll either give me a call or if I can think about it at the close of the service, I've laid it on my desk at the house. I'll try to go get that and bring it over and post it back here on the board, at least where you can copy that, have access to that information, and maybe some cards would assist them at this particular time. As we study together tonight, I want us to learn some of the very timely truths that are just as applicable in our society today as they were indeed in the day in which they were written in the long ago. If you'll take your Bible and open up to the Old Testament book of Ecclesiastes, we're going to be studying just a little bit from some principles that are contained within this marvelous book. I would suggest that as you study the book of Ecclesiastes, that primarily its theme is life under the sun. And the writer identifies himself rather than by person, by designation. In the original language, and sometimes, like in the American Standard Version, by virtue of that, they simply retain that original kind of designation, and at that point he is called Koheleth. Or, for more modern considerations, he is identified as the preacher, as it were, in the King James Version. I would suggest then that basically what you're doing is reading here what constitutes nothing more much than a sermon. And what he is trying to tell us is the things that are very important about life. And I would suggest that one of the ways, and I know there are a number of ways, by which you might be able to try to take just a few minutes and to look at what might be contained within this book, one of the ways it seems to me that is most profitable, because it appears to be the idea that the writer had in mind, is to take the man as he is in the formative years or the prime of life years, however you want to look at it, because he includes and incorporates at least both of those sets of years in what he is viewing. And he stands there looking at life trying to determine something. What he wants to determine is something that everybody basically has had to struggle with at one time or another in their life, and that is, what is the most profitable way is there for me to live life? As he considers that, he is looking at it from a twofold standpoint. The first standpoint is, what is the most profitable way that I can live my life while I'm here on this earth? And as he views that, he recognizes that there are a number of alternatives that are available to him. And one of the things that he will do is to look down the avenue that is available, and as he does so, whether it is because he is Solomon, as some would suggest, and as a result of that has all of the wealth and all of the riches and all of the means and the resources to have researched this kind of a subject on his own, or whether as it is somebody looking at the life of Solomon, as others would suggest, and simply basically recording on the grand experience that Solomon himself maybe undertook, really is of no issue, I guess. But the point is that when you look at the way that the book is laid out, you see somebody who is very exhaustive, as it were, when he looks at various approaches to life and to the idea of what is the most profitable kind of life that I can live. The second thing that he does is that he tempers his view by realizing that it may be possible for me to have determined that this is a profitable way to live life if I only consider humanity. But he recognizes in his approach that there is more than humanity that must be considered, that there is also deity, and that as he contemplates the matter of God, he comes to a very firm realization, and that is that ultimately he is going to face God in the judgment. And so he wants to view the decision-making process not only on what will be profitable for me as I live now, but what will be profitable for me when I stand ultimately before the judgment seat of God, and he will ultimately decide what he is going to do with me and where I will dwell throughout eternity. And he is really concerned that at that juncture, he wants to be able to look back on his life and to say that it was profitable. It was profitable because it gave me the best possible life to live upon the earth. But it was profitable by virtue of the fact that it equipped and prepared me for eternity in the afterwhile. And that now I can hear him say, "Well done." As he views life then, with this kind of an idea in mind, notice as you would read through the book that he throws himself, as it were out here, into a number of different avenues of consideration. And one of those things that he very clearly looks at is the matter of wisdom. And whenever he deals with wisdom, he is generally dealing with the idea of human wisdom rather than divine wisdom. And as he investigates this area of human wisdom, one of the conclusions that he reaches is, it's better to be wise as you live on this earth than to be foolish. Because there are certain advantages that the wise have over those who are fools. And he investigates a number of those things, and we recognize that in our everyday life. And not only do we recognize it, we teach and instill those kind of earthly principles into our young people so that they might be able to learn and benefit even from the mistakes that we have made in the past. And we want them to use their heads and to be wise. We furthermore recognize the need of education, as we would generally identify it, though he would look at it yet again from this idea of human wisdom as such. And basically, we recognize the need for them to be as educated as they possibly can be, and yet at the same time, not to reach the point where they think they know more than he who is their creator, to the point that they ultimately decide that they're going to reject that there is even such a being as the creator. Man then, in his own wisdom, as Paul would say to the Corinthians in the first chapter of the first book that he writes to them, sometimes allows his wisdom to supersede the wisdom of God. And when he allows that to transpire, he sees the wisdom of God, or the spiritual wisdom that God has made available to the sons of men that will meet the real issues of life, as something that is really nothing more than foolishness. And he refuses to bow in the humble submission that God demands out of every person who would be his child, simply because he is full of the wisdom of himself. He's full of human wisdom. And this man investigates that wisdom, and he reaches the end and he says, "That's great. It's better to end up life being wise than being a fool, but I learned something else. I learned that my wisdom would not help me to escape ultimately death. I learned that no matter how wise that I was, it wouldn't keep me out of the judgment before God. And I learned also that the foolish man died just like the wise man. Oh, the wise man in his wisdom may have been able to have prolonged his life a little longer than the foolish man, because in his wisdom he escaped some of the things that folly may have led him into that could have jeopardized even his earthly existence here. Through his wise, cautious living and wisdom, he may have been able to have added a few years to his life, but he could not stave off death. And he said, I found then that this was vanity. To decide that the end purpose, the driving force in a person's life, is summed up in human wisdom, he said, I can't say that. There are advantages there, but that's not the end of life. So he looks elsewhere, and when he does later, he looks at the matter of pleasure. And he wants us to understand that he has investigated pleasure just as fully as he possibly can. And we need to understand that when he investigates that, he does connote the idea that we sometimes use when we think about pleasure, of all of the sinful delights that are there. He seemed to have dabbled in some of those things. And yet most of the time, even when he did that, he recognized that these things had to be tempered even by God, and he was willing to try to at least put some restraints on it so that sociability maybe was the restraint that he saw on his pleasure more than the divine revelation that God had made. But there was also aesthetic beauty that he was concerned about, that he saw and he said were pleasureful. Here was a man who, for example, said that he determined that he was going to look out and construct things. Things that were beautiful. He wanted to make things that were pleasant to the eyes and profitable for human enjoyment. And so he planned parks. He planted trees and shrubbery. He was somebody who was into landscaping. And he said, you know, when I did all of those things, I found that indeed there was a great deal of delight in that. I enjoyed the planning. I enjoyed seeing how it was gradually coming together and how ultimately I was able to look at the handiwork, as it were, of my own hands. And I was out there and I knew that this didn't look in this beautiful way that it had before. And now that I've not only made something that I can delight in as I view it, but something that those who are my subjects in my kingdom can enjoy. Something that will provide pleasure to the lives that they live as well as they benefit from the handiwork of my hands. And he said, I found great enjoyment and delight in that. But he said, at the same time, I realized that this was not something that was incorruptible. This is something that was subject to the works of decay, or sometimes that were subject to the elements. And that as a result of that, all of my work and my efforts could be frustrated rather readily and easily by the handiwork of God. And so he said that when a man gives himself totally over to pleasure, living it up, thinking that really the sum totality of life is viewed from the philosophy that says you only live once, so you better enjoy every single solitary minute of it while you can, because ultimately it's going to end. He says, well, there were certain enjoyable delights that were attached to that as I lived. I realized that that was not the kind of lifestyle that prepared a man to stand profitably before God in the after while. There was more to life than that. It was vanity. It was transitory. It was a striving after the wind. He said, I also investigated some other things that were available out here. For example, I looked down the avenue that we would sum up under the word wealth. Financial security was one of the kinds of considerations that he looked at, riches, and he recognized that there were times that whenever he looked at the matter of riches, that certainly there were some marvelous things that were associated with them. One of the things he learned, doesn't take most of us very long to learn, he learned that it's better to have monetary means than to be poor. He found he'd much rather have wealth than to live with the alternative. But even after he determined that, he found that there were some problems that sometimes he didn't recognize were associated with wealth that he didn't have when he viewed himself as being poor. And so, for example, he spends some time talking about the fact that riches can be harmful to you. For example, over in the fifth chapter, he shows, for example, there beginning in verse 10 through verse 12, the riches are basically unable to satisfy. That no matter how much of this world's goods that you've got, whenever you become a workaholic, and that's really what he'd become during this period of his life, as he was pursuing that goal of financial security, that he found that there was never going to be enough to satisfy him. No matter how much he had, he just didn't have enough. He was just convinced that if he had just a little bit more, then he could be happy. And whenever he gained that, he needed just a little bit more after that. And that's the fellow that's on the treadmill that's out here, basically as a workaholic who's never satisfied, and he gives up an awful lot just because he views life that this is the sum totality of it, just that I'm able to have so much of this world's goods. He also recognized that there were some advantages even to being poor that he didn't see before once he got caught on that treadmill. While he recognized that the poor man sometimes went to bed hungry, he looked at the rich man, probably himself, and thought, there were some times I wish I would have gone to bed hungry. Because you see, now his wealth has afforded him certain richness and delight in his food that he had not formerly been able to obtain. And the richness or the vastness of the amount now caused him to spend many nights of sleeplessness. And he contrasted that with his former days when he was poor. And he recognized that then, even though maybe he was hungry, one of the advantages that he had was a full night's sleep. And he was wanting that very desperately at some points as he pursued the goal of wealth and said, I just couldn't have that. Furthermore, he said, I learned there was something else. And that is that whenever you're rich, people try to sidle up to you. They try to get close to you and get near to you. And they'll praise you and they'll pat you on their back and they'll act like they're your friend. Not because of who or what you are, but because of what you possess. And they want to be able to be close to that. And he said, I learned that there were some false friends that were associated with that kind of a lifestyle. Furthermore, he recognized that inevitably he wasn't going to get to take those things with him. All of the things that he had amassed during a lifetime of struggle and pursuit to obtain were all going to be left behind. And he learned something else, that when they were left behind, they not only were just out of his control because he couldn't do something with it, he recognized that the next fellow might not appreciate it to the fullest extent that he had appreciated it because he'd worked to obtain it. And he said, I came to understand that if I left it to somebody that I thought would appreciate it and evaluate it and use it wisely, sometimes I've seen people make foolish decisions about that, and I've watched it run through the fingers of their heirs when it's been delivered to them. And he said, that was a sore evil. That was a grievance to him that made him bitter within his soul to think that the man who comes after me is going to enjoy the fruit of my labor. I worked all my life to get it, but I never enjoyed it. And the next man is going to enjoy it after me, but maybe he's not going to appreciate it enough that he's just going to squander it. And he said, I saw that as a great evil under the sun. You see, as he pursues this, he looks at it. And many times we look down these same avenues and we don't always see all of the pitfalls and the problems that are there like this fellow has been willing to investigate about that. He also looks down the line of popularity. And whenever he does that, he views the fact that sometimes it's attached in one way or another to one of these other considerations that's there. It may be that if a person decides that this is the sum totality and essence of their life, this is the thing they think is most important, is to be popular, that they're going to be disappointed. That so many times the people that gather and rally around them are there not because of who and what they are, but are there primarily because maybe they want to be close to the wealth that's associated with it. Kind of like in the 15th chapter of the book of Luke, in the case of the prodigal son, that when his inheritance was still within his control, while he still had some of it, and was spending that rather freely, while there were those who were there because of his popularity that were willing to help him enjoy the fruit of his father's labor. But whenever the funds ran out, just like this fellow, one of the things that he learned was that these were not genuine people who were really his friends. They weren't the ones who really counted him and evaluated him highly. He wasn't really popular. It wasn't he that they were after all, but rather what it was that was within his control, and they wanted that. And it might have been that they wanted to be close to pleasure. It may have been they wanted to be close to wisdom or whatever it might have been that characterized this person. But he says the way of popularity is bound to disappoint you. If you look at the book in this manner, I would suggest to you that one of the things then that it does is kind of help to explain why the book almost ends rather abruptly. I would suggest that probably the most familiar verses to the majority of us in the book of Ecclesiastes are the last two verses in the 12th chapter, verses 13 and 14. And I would suggest that really what you have here is the fact that here's a man who's looked at pleasure, he's looked at wisdom, he's looked at wealth, he's looked at popularity. There have been a number of others that we just didn't go into that he's examined in the same kind of fullness that he has these ones. But remember, he is looking for the way that is profitable, not only here, but in eternity. What's going to cause him to be able, when he stands before God, and to have God say, well done, I'm pleased with you. Is it going to be pleasure? No. Is it going to be wisdom, earthly, human wisdom? No. Is it going to be how much you're worth when you die? No. Is it going to be how popular you're popular, if I can say that word, that you were while you were living here? How many friends that you had? No, it's not that at all. He says, when I was looking for what was really going to count, when I finally and ultimately stood before God, this is what I learned. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. For God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. Notice he says that what I learned is that the way that is going to be profitable, the only way that's going to count, is the way that causes me first to fear God, and as a result of that, to keep His commandments. And he says, when I do that, that becomes the sum totality and the essence of man. And notice when he says that, he stops. And why did he stop? Have you ever wondered why he didn't take time once he discovers this? You know, when he was talking about pleasure and trying to find if that was the answer, and wisdom if that was the answer, and wealth if that was the answer, and popularity if that was the answer, you see him a number of times in the book looking at various avenues of all of those things. He goes to it and gives you a little of this and gives you a little of that, and he maybe comes back over here and he goes over there and he talks about this and he tells you all the things that he did. All of a sudden now he just simply says, this is what I learned, fear God and keep His commandments. And then he doesn't say anything about that. Do you know why? Because having found the solution that he's looking for, he simply went out and did it. That's why. And that's all he's trying to get us to see in the book. That there are a number of ways or avenues that are available to man, and that the devil is going to use, and he will in modern society just as successfully as he did when this fellow stands looking for the same answer as he writes the book of Ecclesiastes. And the devil's going to use pleasure, and he's going to catch some of us up in it. He's going to find that there are those of us who love pleasure more than anything else. In fact, even Paul warns in the New Testament that there are men who are going to be lovers of pleasure more than anything else in life. They're pleasure seekers, and their whole life runs around the idea of whether or not it brings them delight and enjoyment, whether it makes them feel good, whether it lifts them and elevates them insofar as their human existence is concerned. And if it does that, they're going to pursue that. And nobody's got the right, according to these people, to stand up and to even suggest that God, let alone anybody else, might think that there was something wrong or even questionable about the activity that they may be involved in. There are others who will throw themselves into human wisdom to the extent and degree that, as we have suggested, they will deny the very Creator who made them. You can look at the rest of it. But he says, the man who comes and ultimately recognizes that this is the sum of the duty of man. This is the whole of man. I realize the word duty is not in that text. Really what he says at that juncture is this. Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep His commandments, for this is the whole of man. The translators added the word duty in an effort to make sense. And I think they probably did about as well as they could do under the conditions that they were working in. Because really that's what he is talking about. What is the whole of man's responsibility? What is the whole of man's obligation? Or the whole of man's duty in this life, and especially as he views God? And that is to fear God and keep His commandments. And do you notice that having said that, that he says that in view of the fact of the judgment, that God will bring every work into judgment with every secret thing, whether it be good or whether it be evil. You see, that's the thing that's tempered all of these others as he's trying to determine what's my duty to do that will make me acceptable before God. When pleasure stood there, even the innocent aesthetic pleasures in which all of us find a great deal of delight, in the hobbies maybe that we have or the things that we just enjoy doing that are right within themselves, he says, I came to understand that in the judgment that doesn't mean anything before God. I came to understand that it doesn't matter how smart you are as men evaluate you with the wisdom of men when you stand before God. I mean, it really won't make any difference. The final examination is not going to be, okay, here's an old clunker, Joe, take it apart and make it run. And if you make it run, you get to go in the pearly gates. But if you can't do it, so long, we're going to flip the trap door and down you go. He says, it's not that. That's not the consideration. And he said, when I looked at well as it was viewed in the judgment, it took on an entirely different meaning than it did when I looked at it from an earthly perspective. From an earthly perspective, it said, this is everything. This is the sum totality of life. What life's all about is getting to the top of the heap. Being able to say, I've got more than others have got. He said, but you know, in the judgment, the Lord's not going to say, let's see your bank account. Let's see what your stocks and bonds, how wise you were in your investments while you lived. Did it reach a certain figure? If it didn't meet that magic figure, I'm sorry, you're lost. But if it did that or went above, you can come on in. He said, I learned that wasn't the determining factor. And the same thing about how many people liked me or didn't like me. That's not the answer in the judgment. And he said, when I tempered these things in the judgment, then it caused me to understand that while there were certain benefits in this life to all of these things, and he doesn't condemn any of them to the point where he says, thou shalt not enjoy or have anything to do with any of them. He realizes that life is made up of some of these things. But what he tries to do is to cut through those and to get us to see that spiritual things are the most important. He did the very same kind of thing, did he not, that Jesus did in the 6th chapter of the book of Matthew. When he looks down through earthly life, when he talks about the fact that no man can serve two masters, that he'll love the one and hate the other, he'll hold the one and despise the other, you can't serve God and mammon. He goes down and he takes us through some of the very basic fundamentals of life. He tries to get us to look out here, even into nature, and see how God cares for those things, and they don't plan and purpose ahead of time. And he's not saying we can't do it, but he's saying don't get so overly concerned about the things of this life, things that fall in these quarters, to where you do what? To where you don't seek the kingdom of God and his righteousness first in your life. That's exactly what this man said. He gives you the view of his life that says, I was in a position that other people envy. And I was able to just examine everything that was out there to the very fullest extent of my heart's desire. And I've learned something that I can help you with. You don't have to do what I did. You don't have to go down the road to pleasure to find out that's the road to ruin. That's the road that'll take you away from God. He says, I've been there, and I can tell you that's what it'll do. He says, if you want to be near God, if you want his favor and his approval, if you want the best possible life that can be lived now and hear God say, well done, enter in the after while, this is what you do. You fear God and keep his commandments. Now, with that as a background, just look at a couple of verses with me. As he winds down here, notice in the latter portion of chapter 11 that he says in verse 9, to rejoice, O young man, in thy youth, and let thy heart cheer thee in the days of thy youth, and walk in the ways of thine heart and in the sight of thine eyes. But know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. The first thing I guess we need to point out is that when he uses the word young as well as youth there in verse 9, he uses a word in the Hebrew language that means the formative years of life. So he's talking about what most of us would consider to be young people. And I suggest that the advice that he gives here, the words that he gives here, are indeed some very ancient words that are just as applicable to modern youth as they were in the people who lived as the teenagers, we might say, of the day and time in which he lived. And you know, one of the things that he says is to enjoy life in the days of your youth, to enjoy your formative years. And you know, that's a hard thing to say. Primarily because so many times when that's said, we sit back and we think, boy, I'd hate to think these really are the best days of my life. I mean, if this is the best and it's going to go downhill from here, I just really don't think I've got much of a good outlook where life is concerned. Well, he's not always saying it just from the standpoint of the way we think about it when that's said. But what he's saying is that these are years where you don't have a great many of the burdens and the weights of responsibilities that will ultimately come in the latter days of your life. You're not carrying a house payment. You're not carrying the burden and the responsibility of trying to be financially responsible for not only yourself, but for other mouths to feed within that family. You don't feel the weight and the burden of decision making that has to be made in view of the direction that a family is going to go insofar as it faces the things that modern life hurls against it. that hopefully what you have is a mother and a father who are rooted and founded in this philosophy of life, that they're going to fear God and keep His commandments, and that they're going to lead and teach and instruct and guide, that the influence of their life is going to be in such a manner that without you really thinking about it, you're going to be led in a pathway that is going to draw you ever closer to God rather than farther away from Him. And what that says is that what he's talking about to young people says something to those of us who are the parents of those young people at the same time, you see. We need to understand that our young people need to be just that. They need to be able to enjoy the formative years of their life. We do not need to be rushing them out here into life. There's a lot that's out there. And there are a lot of burdens and responsibilities and weights and evils that are there that really they don't need to have to face until really they just have to do that. And it seems to me that we who are Christians, that our children of all children in the world ought to be the most naive. We ought to do some sheltering. We ought to do some protecting. They ought not to know some of these four-letter words. It ought to be a shock to your kid when he goes out here and gets in the school system. You ought to hear when they come home, what does four-letter word mean? Because what that's saying is, you have led them in a direction that is not of the thinking of the world. It's not of the philosophy of the world. You have governed and guided and helped to control not only yourself, but the things that have influenced them in the family, in the home structure itself. You've done some monitoring of that little box or boxes that all of us have got in our home, sometimes in a variety of different rooms, with all of the different kind of programming that's on there. That you've done some monitoring and some guiding and some teaching insofar as some of the music that comes over the airways and that wants to fill the minds of our young people with. Because I'll just tell you, when you get down and listen to some of it very closely, it's amazing how many four-letter words. It's amazing the kind of suggestiveness insofar as acts and activities and actions that some of these people that are out here influencing by virtue of song, and our young people tell us, I don't listen to the words, I'm just running along with the music. But those words are there. And whether we're knowing them or not knowing them, consciously or unconsciously, they're having an effect. Recently, I talked with another person, and they said, you know what? So he said, I've given up recommending movies to go see. And I said, well, what do you mean? He said, well, I'll tell you what. He said, somebody came to me not very long ago. This fellow was a preacher now. And he said, they said, what do you know about this movie? And he said, oh, yeah, we went and saw that. We thought it was great. We really loved it. And he said, you know what? He said, that family went and they saw that movie and they came back. And he said, the fellow pulled me off the side and he said, you really think that was a good movie? And he said, yeah, I really liked it. He said, well, what did you think about all those four-letter words that were in there? He said, I said, what? What do you mean four-letter words? I didn't hear any four-letter words in there. He said, man, it was just full of four-letter words all the way through. He said, you know what? I guess what's happened is I have become so accustomed to hearing some of those words that I just kind of blot them out. I don't even realize they're there when they're there anymore. And he said, I've decided that that's not a good trait to have. That those words ought to be an offense to my sensibility. But hey, I'm going to tell you folks, most of us are aware of the fact that even in our society today, we look at what we used to call cussing, and don't we have some polite cuss words now? I mean, that's the way the world looks at it. They're the ones that they slip into the family viewing hour out here on TV. It's the ones that hardly will give a movie out here a rating of PG just based on the fact that there are two or three four-letter words that have become so common that everybody says them and the people don't even think about them hardly in the same word as the four-letter word concept. But in the past, we looked at it and there was nothing polite about that. In the movie Gone with the Wind, you know the word that Rhett Butler said at the end of that, that everybody knows about, that created such a fervor? That's one of the polite cuss words now. You can use that, and it doesn't mean anything different than most other polite words that you can use because people are so used to hearing it, it doesn't offend the sensibilities of people. And what that's saying is that the number of those kind of words are just going to grow as society accepts more and more and more of them. But among those of us who are Christians, it shouldn't be that way. And that's primarily part of what he's saying right here. He also reminds us that while we're enjoying these days, remember his viewpoint. His viewpoint is not only the best life I'm living now, but the best life I'm living in view of God, that he tempers even this with the judgment. And he says, but know thou that for all these things God will bring thee into judgment. He says to remember that in your youth. Remember that there are some things that sometimes get their start in youth that you'll spend the rest of your life trying to overcome. And he elaborates more on that in verse 10 when he says, therefore remove sorrow from thy heart and put away evil from thy flesh. For childhood and youth are vanity. Now, one of the things I want you to be aware of is that here he says childhood, there's your formative years, but the word he uses for youth this time is a different word. And it is a word that means the prime of life. And so now he takes in those early years of life and whatever may constitute in our thinking the prime of life as well. And basically what he says is something that those of us who are older know very well, that life gets by very quickly. Hey, can you believe that it's October already? I mean, it just seems like this year started. And it's more over than it is just started. Where did the year go? Where did all of those days, because we're on the declining end of the scale of a year now, where did all those days go? What did we do with them? Were they spent profitably? You see, he says that's the way life passes, very quickly, very rapidly. And he says, recognizing that, don't allow in your youth and in the prime of your life to get involved in actions and activity that are going to put within you guilt or sorrow. Don't engage in activities in your youth that you're going to spend the rest of your life trying to live down. And that are always going to be a distress to you. That you're going to turn around and look at and wish just as much as you could, know that you can't do it, that you wish you could turn the clock back and go back to another time and readjust this one little thing, because it would have such a vastly different impact in changing your life if you could just do that. Again, so often in our youth, or even in the prime of our life, we start things that we spend the rest of our life regretting. He says, don't do that. Think of the consequences of your actions beforehand. And you see, if you can live with this philosophy, to fear God and keep his commandments, it'll do a great deal of that, because God has insulated those who will bow in submission to his will from many of those things that'll produce sorrow in you. You know, there are some, as the world calls it, first-timers in the area of moral sexual impurity that get AIDS. The very first time. And with it, they get the death sentence, because that's what AIDS brings. There are some others who, by virtue of that, which is supposed to be something that is rapturous and one of the most happy expressions of life that can be, and they end up with some kind of a disease that they have to battle and combat the rest of their life. You see, what he says, in view of the activities of your life, remove sorrow from your heart. If God's will had been respected in these matters, by all parties, we wouldn't have those kind of problems to work with and affecting us in our society. You think about the person who decides in their youth that they're going to show their manliness by going out and showing they can hold their liquor. What happens? It may lead to the life of an alcoholic. Look at the person who decides that they're going to really show that they're adults. You know, they're going to grow up, and so what do? They go out and light them up something as simple as a cigarette, and they spend the rest of their life trying to break that habit. Or maybe it's a marijuana cigarette. Or maybe it's something that they're going to sniff or inject in their veins, and that it hooks them to the extent that finally they take their own life by virtue of the drug that they're on. What he tells us is that while we enjoy our life, certainly he had enjoyed his, that you remove sorrow from it. And the best way you can do that is the philosophy that he's gearing us to receive, because it's the way of life. I think there's a lot that can be learned, and our time is gone, from this marvelous book of the Old Testament. And yet, basically, this is the outline that you see of it. What about you? Has your life been one that's been willing to remember your Creator in the days of your youth? That's where he goes next, in the 12th chapter in verse 1. And the idea there is not just something that you're able to pull back up into the memory banks of your mind like you can pull something up on the screen of a computer, but rather the idea of you bring it up for the purpose of its having some effect upon you for that which is good, that will benefit you insofar as life is concerned. And that's what he wants us to do in the remembering of our Creator. Do we remember tonight that indeed we are not here by virtue of what we ourselves are or may, but rather that we are here as the handiwork of God, that we are here with people who have a purpose, there's a destiny that we have. Do we have the willingness to admit what this man admitted about himself? And that is that ultimately he was going to stand before the judgment seat of God on the last day. And that when he stood there, he wanted to stand there in a profitable way, in a way with which God would view him and say, well done. That begins tonight by your willingness to accept Jesus Christ in the gospel, the terms that he lays down in the gospel. Jesus said, he that believeth is baptized shall be saved. He that believeth not shall be damned. If your desire is to live a profitable life, to show that what you do is to fear God and are willing to keep his commandments, you have that reverence and respect, that adoration and awe of God, it will cause you to just simply do what he bids you to do. If you started that road, but somewhere or another, maybe you got sidetracked on one of those other avenues that were there. The devil's going to use them, and he's got great fields for every one of them and a host more. Where your life has just simply been led down the sidetrack that ultimately is not going to lead to acceptability before God in the afterlife, then what you need to do is to get back on track tonight and renew your covenant relationship with the Lord, repenting of those things that are amiss and seeking the forgiveness of God through the avenue of prayer. Aren't you willing tonight to show that God means more to you than anything in life and that you're willing to live? Won't you do that right now while we sing?